babies who were exposed to alcohol during pregnancy can develop lifelong developmental disabilities known collectively as fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, or FASD. The effects can be subtle to severe, and every person is affected differently, making diagnosis challenging but critical for better life outcomes. A new documentary features the stories of Alaskans living with FASD and their journey toward learning skills for a happy life. We'll learn more about the tools for coping with FASD today on Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Invasive plants and animals threaten Alaska's waters and can spread to new locations by hitching a ride. Anyone can help stop aquatic hitchhikers by remembering to clean boots, boats, and trailer to remove plants, animals, and mud. Drain bilge, ballast, and buckets before leaving the area, and dry equipment before using it in a new body of water. Learn more at stopaquatichitchhikers.org. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. For too long, stigma, fear, and guilt around FASD meant some families were in denial about their child's struggles, wanting to hide it from others, or didn't have good information about what could happen to a developing baby if alcohol was used during pregnancy. But Alaska has made big strides in efforts to educate about the risks of FASD, and a center dedicated to supporting individuals who are challenged by these disabilities opened here in 2017. Joining me to talk about diagnosis, treatment, and the tools for living full and happy lives despite FASD are Terry Tibbett. Terry is the president of the Alaska Center for FASD, and Terry is also the statewide coordinator of the Alaska Prenatal Alcohol Partnership. In the studio, Marilyn Pierce-Bulger has worked in healthcare related to FASD for nearly 30 years and is a founder of the Alaska Center for FASD that opened in 2017. And Gina Shoemaker is a self-advocate and adult with FASD who is also on the board of directors for the center. Welcome, all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks so much. And Terry is on the line with us. You can also join us. Do you have questions about FASD or a story to share about your own journey? You can call us statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're calling from Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Marilyn, start us off with a description. Fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, FASD, is the overarching term.
Right.
Fetal alcohol syndrome was what I first heard this referred to 20-some years ago. Help us understand more of what is encompassed in this spectrum and how understanding it has developed through the years.
Oh, thank you for that question. So this is the 50th anniversary of recognition of the syndrome, fetal alcohol syndrome, by the University of Washington in 1973. And there were a couple of residents who recognized that the children of women who had experienced alcohol addiction looked differently. And these were children that had the facial features that we associate with full FAS. And those features include a small eye opening, which makes the area at the bridge of the nose look wider across that part of the face. The upper lip is very thin relative to the lower lip, and there's a vertical groove beneath the nose to the upper lip that is less distinctive. So those three features, the facial features of FAS, only are impacted in the third week of gestation, third week of pregnancy. So if the alcohol exposure didn't happen in that time period, many individuals with FASD with the spectrum disorder do not have the facial features. So full FAS is evidence of brain injury, the facial features, and then usually small growth, which is height or weight below the 10th percentile. There are people who have partial FAS, where they may have just the facial features but not the growth or vice versa, and evidence of brain dysfunction. And then the other folks on the spectrum might have alcohol-related neurodevelopmental disorder, which is the evidence of brain-based differences. And because the brain is developing the entire 9 months of pregnancy, alcohol, which is a teratogen, can actually kill and alter developing cells at any point during the gestational stage. So basically what happens is our brains got the brain got rewired, and there may be dead ends or rerouting of those pathways that are the normal pathways. So then that shows up as performance or other challenges in things like communication or sensory issues or executive function, which is the frontal part of the brain that we all grow into as we get into our 20s. Virtually everybody with an FASD has some struggle with those frontal lobe functions because that part of the brain is what's the other parts have grown into over time. And then some people have alcohol-related birth defects, the birth defects, which can be physical manifestations of the alcohol exposure, the facial features being one of them. But there are other things. When I was running the diagnostic team here in Anchorage, my colleagues were finding really interesting things like scoliosis and joint deformities and joint laxity, and some birth defects are actually associated, like midline birth defects are associated with prenatal exposure. And the medical community really doesn't necessarily put two and two together when they're looking at individuals who have these deformities.
So fascinating. Scoliosis associated.
Yes, yes. I mean, there's just this, the alcohol can, of course, is very variable from, you know, person to person in terms of how much they might have consumed or how their body processes it. One of the things that many people really don't realize is that the blood alcohol content for the baby is identical to mom's, essentially. Mm. The placenta is a sieve. It's not really doing anything to protect that developing baby from the alcohol. So if you think about mom's weight of, you know, 130, 40-pound person and their alcohol from a couple, three drinks of alcohol, that baby is, you know, however much that baby weighs, and their alcohol, blood alcohol content's quite exponentially different in terms of how it impacts them.
Toxic.
Yeah.
You mentioned the FASD diagnostic team and ran that for
10 years,
about a decade
10 years, yeah.
Before the center opened. Tell us about that diagnosis process and what you learned in that 10 years.
Oh, my gosh. the diagnostic process is such, it's so hard because brain function is difficult to assess to begin with, right? Because we're complicated creatures, and we need professional perspectives from different to take a different look at the how this brain is functioning. So generally, there's a psychologist, a speech language pathologist, an occupational therapist that are looking at sensory and overall brain function, motor coordination things, how your communication works. Many individuals who have FASD have what we say are social communication challenges, which is where they misread cues with other people, which makes them very vulnerable then to the influence of others. They're often taken advantage of. Gina can talk about that. And then there's a medical professional. It could be a nurse practitioner or a physician who is doing the physical exam and really looking at the facial features and the big picture with regard to their medical history. And then usually a navigator or somebody who's a family advocate that's helping the family or the individual to walk through the process of the diagnostic team. Mm. And the teams in Alaska have really varied widely over the years. We had $29 million from federal funding back in the early 2000s, from 2000 to 2005 or 6, roughly in that time period. And at one point, we had 14 diagnostic teams around the state. And then the funding was diminishing over time, but also it's very difficult to maintain these kinds of professional groups in small and remote locations, right? So that's always been a challenge for the state in terms of how do we make diagnosis more accessible across the state. And in fact, right now, there's not a functioning diagnostic team in Anchorage. There's some professionals who were on the team who are still very FASD informed in terms of how they do their practice. But the current teams that I'm aware of are down in Soldotna and Fairbanks and out in the valley at Ptarmigan Connections.
And so does that mean that children, babies in the Anchorage area just aren't able to be screened?
Unfortunately, there's not a professional group that's focusing on that. Prior to when we had, I had to close the diagnostic team because it wasn't a sustainable entity as a set-aside sort of clinic system. It really needs to be part of the healthcare system. And we were moving towards that happening, and then the infrastructure around that didn't, the support from management didn't happen. So that has languished at this point.
Oh, my gosh.
There are professionals who are interested in this, but it's not organized.
Mm. Well, that's dismaying to hear. Terry, I want to turn to you now. There are an estimated 47,000 Alaskans living with this disorder. My editor this morning checked that number and said, "Where did you get this? That seems very high." And I said, "Yeah, it's in the documentary." Have rates been falling in recent years as people better understand the dangers of alcohol use during pregnancy?
You know, thanks for that question. I think Marilyn would be a better person to answer that if I can.
Okay.
For her.
All right. So the 47,000 number came from a report that's actually put together periodically called The Cost of Alcohol Misuse in Alaska. And the latest version was 2019. Done on behalf of the Alaska Mental Health Trust. That was the first report that they'd done, and they'd been done over many years, that actually had a chapter to focus on FASD-related costs. We know how many individuals in Alaska have FAS because that tends to be the visible part of the disability, but only about 10% of people on the spectrum are the individuals who have the FAS, the full FAS. So virtually everybody else is walking around with a hidden disability, and it's harder to, because each of them have a unique set of symptoms, if you will, and their clinical presentation may be quite different, it's very hard to identify that. So that's where that number came from. But to go back to your question about whether numbers are changing, we have seen decreased numbers for a period of time. We saw a decrease in terms of women's alcohol consumption in Alaska, but I think it's on the rise again. And there's really some interesting work looking nationally at the role the alcohol industry has played in marketing directly to women over the last 30 years, and it's working. And the women who are drinking today in pregnancy tend to be 30-something white, college-educated working women.
Hmm. Do you suspect the number is much higher than 47,000, that a lot of people just have learned to cope with whatever their challenges are and just haven't been diagnosed?
I don't know that there's a way to answer that. I because of the stigma related to alcohol use during pregnancy, there's a lot of denial around that. And one of the things that I think is an important point to make is that I've been in the health professional field for, 40 some years, and about half of individuals get pregnant when they don't plan on it, and that number hasn't changed in those 40 some years. Mm. What has changed is how pregnant people are drinking. And as recently as 2015, that number was roughly 1 in 10 women. This was national data. That number is now 1 in 7.
Ouch.
So we're going in the wrong direction, and there's this kind of oppositionality around "don't tell me what to do." That CDC got some big pushback about some messaging they were doing a few years ago, and I get that that they made mistakes in terms of how they were doing the messaging. But the bottom line is that there's just not been the acceptance, I guess, of the information around alcohol. And also, the other thing that I've seen is because unplanned pregnancies have not really shifted, you're just living your life and you might be going out having a Friday, Saturday night, some drinks with your friends, and you may be doing that for a few weekends before you realize you're pregnant. And then you stop and you don't necessarily say anything to your medical provider when you do go in for care, if you're getting care, because you just don't think about it. But that alcohol prior to pregnancy recognition matters too. As I said, the facial features happen in the third week of gestation.
Gina, you were diagnosed at 50.
Yes.
Talk about before you had that clarity, what was your life like as far as working through day-to-day problems?
It was a struggle. I didn't really know why I struggled with numbers, time, money, and relationships, and didn't understand what it could be. I thought it was environmental because I grew up in a home with very little supervision. And so I blamed it on that for a long time. But I had a friend that told me how hard it was to raise children with FASD. And I looked at them and I thought, they can't have it. They don't look like it. And it was an aha moment for me. And for the next few years, I started reading about it. Things would pop up and I'd learn more about it. And I thought, that's definitely what I have. But I didn't know what to do about it. And I decided to look into getting a diagnosis because I wanted to advocate for others and be a voice for those that can't. And so that's what I did. And after the diagnosis, which was tedious, I had to go through a couple of them, actually, because the first neuropsych told me that my FASD wasn't bad enough to diagnose, that I needed to deal with my PTSD, and that I had other issues that I needed to worry about. And that wasn't a good enough answer for me because I wanted to have the diagnosis that I deserved. And so I went down to Soldotna and got hooked up with a great team, Frontier, and they were wonderful with me. They did the physical, they did the everything, my speech. The neuropsych is very difficult. It's about 4 hours long testing. And when I came out of that, I realized that I needed to do something with that information. So I contacted Marilyn and asked her if I could join the board of directors and see what I could do to make a difference.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and today we're talking about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder and a new documentary that's coming out that shares the stories of the lives of Alaskans living with FASD. In the studio with me today is Marilyn Pierce Bulger, who is a healthcare professional and has been focused on FASD for 30 years. Gina Shoemaker is a self-advocate adult with FASD, and Gina is also on the board of directors for the center. And Terry Tibbett is the president of the Alaska Center for FASD and also the coordinator for the Alaska Prenatal Alcohol Partnership. If you have questions about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder or you want to share your own story, you can call us statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Gina, in the documentary, you mentioned that you're vulnerable to people who would take advantage of your trusting nature. How have you, talk about how you manage that as a very, very busy woman who has three jobs, runs a business, and works in two other areas. How do you help yourself to make sure that no one is taking advantage of you?
It's a daily struggle. I have to be real careful because agents have tended to take advantage of my kindness, and I've had my belongings kept from me. And
she does home staging.
The home staging. And that's been difficult for me, but I've gotten to the point where I'm a little bit more savvy about it, and I realize that I have to have boundaries. And that's an important part of having FASD, is the boundaries. And I have learned that I can say no, which is very difficult for me, because we're people pleasers. We like to please everyone. And that's an important part to learn so that people don't take advantage, because they know that you're going to go above and beyond. And sometimes that can get you into trouble.
Mm-hmm. Marilyn, beyond Gina's story of how a diagnosis helped her, why is it important for people to get tested if they think they may have FASD? Are there medicines that can help, or is it mainly learning coping skills?
I think it's both. And depending on the age when somebody gets a diagnosis, that diagnosis may change over time. Like if you see a child who's under the age of 6, their brain development hasn't gotten to the point where the full evidence of how much impact they have may not be something you can test for yet. So you might have, let's say, a neurobehavioral disorder diagnosis as a young child, And then as you get older, past 10 into your late elementary into middle school years, you may see that that person's significantly more challenged with regard to skills that they need in order to function day to day. And again, if you're struggling with the executive function skills, which are those things like planning and organizing and self-monitoring, being able to control your emotions, managing time, working memory. Memory is a challenge for many, many individuals with FASD. They really wrestle with that and have many, cues they use in order to help them with that. But the bottom line is that the individuals, I've seen children very young who are thinking badly of themselves because they think it's their fault, whatever's going on with them. And having an understanding about how your brain does and doesn't work is life-changing. It's freeing, as Gina said. Like, it just made you, it helped you just feel like you could be kinder to yourself, right? And there's some controversy in the parent community in Alaska around some individuals feel like a diagnosis is a label, and I really challenge that assumption. I think a diagnosis is an explanation for what's going on with regard to what's happening with this child. For example, attention deficit disorder is a very common co-condition with FASD, and the treatments are often medications, but they may not be medications that work particularly well with an individual's got a brain that was altered by prenatal exposure. So if you knew that and you're the prescribing provider, you might choose a very different medicine for them, and or depending on the age of the individual, you maybe need an occupational therapy person to really work with this person, because it may be their sensory system that is functioning in a way that's really creating their distractibility and their attentional problem. And so it does make a big difference in terms of what the interventions might be.
Terry, when I first came to Alaska nearly 24 years ago, I was told you could not raise this issue, that you could not report on it, and people would not talk about it. There was just too much pain around the topic. How has that changed since the 90s?
Well, I think that, first of all, I mean, people have become more aware, in Alaska anyway, because of the federal funding that came in from Senator Ted Stevens and the diagnostic teams developing in the state. And we're one of the only states with diagnostic teams, mm-hmm. We've been able to raise awareness. There has the state of Alaska FASD program in the Department of Health has done a lot in terms of developing training for FASD 101, 102, 201, and 101 and 201. And those trainings have been given statewide. There has been lots of awareness campaigns. We did some stuff in the restaurants over several years, where we put table tents on tables across the state that gave some information about fetal alcohol spectrum disorders and not drinking during pregnancy. And there's just been lots and lots of events. Plus, we have September FASD Awareness Month, and that has been celebrated throughout the state across different cities in the state that have been helping to raise awareness in individual communities. So I think in terms of how it's changed, I think it relates a lot to the raising awareness that people have, the events and the different kinds of tools that have been laid out in throughout the state to help raise awareness. So I think more people know about it. But in terms of how much has changed, I think advocates will tell you it's really slow change. That stigma piece is pretty intense for a lot of people. It's hard to admit that you might have, because of your drinking during pregnancy, you might have caused the damage to your child that that the child is experiencing, or now an adult is experiencing. It's hard to admit that. It's hard to face that. And so I think there's still a lot of stigma. We tend to, criticize people who drink during pregnancy. And I think there can be that fear that people will blame you, or a medical professional will be disappointed in you if you admit these things. So, you know, I think those are still really alive, those fears and that hesitation to speak about it and to, you know, kind of address it.
I think one of the points, one of the reasons we created the center was to try to work on this specifically. And I think the way to do that is having people like Gina, who experiences firsthand, talking and sharing story and really connecting with other people with similar story. And I would say the same is true for the pregnant individuals who have given birth to children who then are affected. And in many families, that might be a multi-generational impact. One of the things we didn't mention yet is that there is an epigenetic impact from prenatal exposure. And so the animal model studies are telling us that, and we're seeing this in humans as well, but we don't do the studies on them, is that there's these, the drinking may have happened a generation or two ago. The immediate offspring might have the most impact. And then even if they don't drink during their pregnancies, they may have children that also are having attentional or other kinds of challenges. So alcohol has the power to really turn signaling pathways on and off.
And I want to talk about that more after the break, but I want to get to a caller before we have to head into a break here. Tony is in Palmer. Hi, Tony.
Hi. Hi, Lori.
Did you have a comment or a question?
Yeah, I have a comment. I've taught FASD students at Whaley School, where they kind of are funneled to after they get kicked out of their regular schools. These are teens I taught, mostly grade 7 to age 22. Mostly, I'd say 15 to age 22 I had, and I had them for about 12 years. And when I got my truck this morning, I was really pleased to hear that the show was focused on this topic, because as your guests have already mentioned, that there's a stigma, there's a lot of information that's not known, even though, you know, Alaska is, I think, per capita, the state with the most kiddos with FASD. And it's kind of a really good thing to get this out there. And there's a lot of good news. I mean, we're learning so much more about it. And I'm here to tell you that if you get in a place where you can be with these kiddos for a period of time and have some knowledge, you know, some scientific knowledge as to what causes it. And of course, there's some, you know, sad news. It really can't be cured, but there are ways to take the edge off to teach others involved in these, in the lives of these kids, what works and what doesn't work. Their parents know. Are you with me?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So the one thing is, these kids are bright. They are creative. They're very trustworthy. If you give them a job, and the trust is the key. These kids grow up and they're not neglected. I mean, I don't judge people who, you know, have to raise kiddos like this, because what FASD does, especially full-blown fetal alcohol syndrome, it affects the part of the brain that regulates behavior.
Right.
And these kiddos don't have a regulator. They have an on-off switch that goes 0 to 60.
Are you, Tony, are you still teaching? Are you still working with youth? Or
I just retired.
Okay.
I keep in contact with, in fact, I'm visiting one of my kiddos today. He's like 24 years old now, and he works at the Alaska Native Medical Hospital as a line cook.
That's
now.
Great.
He needs some support. And I taught kids on various parts of the spectrum. One student I still keep in contact with, he lived at API. He could not even, you know, his least restrictive environment was API. But now he found somebody in a group home that, you know, he can, they live fine together.
Great. Tony, thank you. I really appreciate you the call, and thank you so much for the work that you have been doing all these years on behalf of Alaskans who have this challenge and helping them out. We really appreciate that. We do need to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue with calls and questions and our discussion on fetal alcohol spectrum disorder as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The seafood industry puts thousands of Alaskans to work across the state. From fishermen and scientists to mechanics and shipping agents, the seafood industry sustains Alaska's economy all year long. Alaskans take pride in the work ethic that drives the state in ways big and small. Seafood sustains Alaska. This message sponsored by Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing FASD today, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And on the line with us is Terry Tibbett, president of the Alaska Center for FASD and also the coordinator for the Alaska Prenatal Alcohol Partnership. In the studio with me today is Marilyn Pierce-Balger, who is a healthcare professional and has focused on FASD work for nearly 30 years. And Gina Shoemaker is a self-advocate adult with FASD. And Gina is also on the board of directors for the center, the Alaska Center for FASD. You can join our conversation statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. We were talking before the break about the impacts of alcohol use, but I wanted to turn toward the father's involvement too, because the onus isn't always just on the mother. So, Marilyn, help us understand the father's role in these situations.
There's increased research really looking at paternal contribution to not just the prenatal exposure, but the quality of sperm, prior to conception, and there's some interesting work that was done recently down at Texas A&M University with an animal model. It was mice, and they were exposing pregnant mother mice with to alcohol, and then what they were seeing is the placentas in these pregnancies were less efficient. They got bigger because they weren't as effective. So things tend to grow bigger when they're trying to do their job, right? Mm-hmm. And then they decreased size. That even though the placenta was bigger, the mouse pup was smaller. It was still having trouble growing. And the risk for the pup appeared to be moderated by the influence of both the mother mouse's genetics, but also the gender of the offspring. And the males were more at risk for having more difficulty than the females. And then what they were also saying is that there's so much stigma, of course, as we've talked about, related to maternal alcohol use, and that we're seeing more and more studies looking at paternal alcohol use and really the need for everybody not using alcohol, prior to conception when that's possible and when you're planning a pregnancy. But with the new research, they're asking the question about whether or not assessing paternal drinking should be part of an FASD diagnostic process and not just looking at maternal alcohol use.
Interesting. So if dad was a heavy alcohol user, that could affect the quality of...
Exactly. And again, these are studies in their early, phases of development. But the one thing I found fascinating, because we've had government labels on alcohol since the 70s or 80s, right? Surgeon General warnings on you know, bottles of everything. But they're saying alcohol use by either parent can have significant life-changing consequences for a future child. And they're suggesting that be the messaging on alcohol and not just that alcohol can cause birth defects. Because we think about birth defects as being obvious physical malformations. And in fact, the biggest malformation is how the brain got built, which we can't see.
Yeah, absolutely. The documentary focuses on eight keys: advocacy, mm-hmm. strengths, communication, relationships, interdependence, boundaries, expectations, and structure. Terry, do you want to talk us through the focus on these points and how this came together?
Again, thanks for that question. I would again lob this over to Marilyn because she with Deb Evenson, the two of them co-produced this film, and these eight keys are originated with Deb Evenson's her work that she's been doing for several decades, many decades. And Marilyn will know more about the keys that went into this particular film. So I think I want to give it back to Marilyn
All
to
right.
explain that.
Marilyn.
So the origin story is that there was a fabulous animated production produced by the Anchorage School District about 10 years ago called Eight Magic Keys. It had a main character named Mario, and Mario was a teenager who was describing things that happened to him both at school and in his home and community life where things didn't go quite the way they should. He had FASD, and people, educators perhaps, weren't quite getting it. Mm-hmm. But the beauty of that little video was that it then showed how those people could shift what they were doing to be more helpful to him. So fast forward 10 years, and the FASD coordinator for the state of Alaska, Hope Finkelstein, had the thought about, well, let's think about a sequel, or, you know, promoting another idea with this. So Deb, we hired Deb. The center hired Deb Evenson to work with us. And we got a focus group of eight adults with FASD, Alaskans, who Deb and I then facilitated them coming up with what are the strategies that help you be successful in adulthood. That's where the eight strategies you just list came from, is from these adults. We then helped them craft questions that were the interview questions. So really, this whole new movie is their movie. They helped create the strategies. They designed the questions. We then contracted with Dan Redfield, who's a fabulous filmmaker here in town, and he put everything on film. And then we have a new version. Mario has grown up, and we have an animated Mario who's introducing these keys.
Gina, I saw you nodding as Marilyn was talking about it. Talk about your role in helping with how to put this all together and what you wanted people to know.
Well, I wanted to raise awareness and end the stigma. I kind of wanted people to look at us differently and see us as an invisible disability. You know, it's something that we all live with, and we all have different tools and different strategies to help us. And so by getting together with others like-minded, it was really fun to be able to come up with something that you knew could make a difference in people's lives. And I enjoyed it.
We talked a little before we went on air about my father's disability, which was very, very apparent, a very noticeable, visible physical disability, and how people treated him at times because of that. But I wonder about the challenges that you must face with such an invisible disability and how that at times is probably even harder than it was for my father.
Absolutely. It's people's expectations are unrealistic a lot when it comes to us, because they look at us and think, oh, you're a certain age and you should act a certain way. And it doesn't quite work like that for our brains.
Or your IQ is a certain level and you're not functioning at that level.
Right.
That seems difficult for both you to manage and to help someone understand. And as a person in business, is that sort of part of your, when you're working with a new client, is that right up front?
No, I don't really share it. It's not something that I feel like they need to know. My clients in my salon all know, because I've grown up in the salon with them and they help mother me. And a few of them had to recognize that their children could have FASD, and that might be why they've struggled all their lives, because these women are in their 90s and they all drank while they were pregnant. Mm-hmm. So it was a little bit enlightening for me, but it was hard for them to face that. And that made it a little bit difficult. But I think that by raising awareness and getting the word out and having people look at me differently and see me as a person that has a hidden disability can be a good thing, because I think that when I go to AFN, you know, I really enjoyed touching base with people that could understand, because when they'd stop at our booth for the center and start talking and I would say, well, I have it. And they would look at me like shocked, like everybody does. And I said, yeah, I got diagnosed at 50. And there's a lot of things that you can do to help yourself. There's tools, there's strategies. It's not a horrible disease to have. There's people think of things that you could have, disabilities. And it is one of those things that it is a daily struggle, but it's one of those things that's worth it if you can reach other people and help be a voice for those that can't.
How, when you think about, you were talking about some of your clients and their growing realization that, oh gosh, maybe my own child is also experiencing this. How, and Marilyn, your work as well, how do you help parents cope with this knowledge? Their child is diagnosed with FASD and they realize this was completely preventable. And now they have to help their child cope for the rest of their life. The weight of guilt has to be really enormous. And guilt isn't helpful. No. So how do you help them process this?
I think what Gina said earlier about forgiving herself, like being more gentle with yourself, because we're just living our lives and half of people are getting pregnant still and don't know they're pregnant. And we may just have drinking patterns that maybe potentially cause a problem. I actually changed how I was doing clinical practice when I was doing new prenatal exams. And I would talk with clients around, there's a prenatal exposure between, you know, this time period in your pregnancy, and I can't tell you if this may cause a problem for this child. It might reveal itself over time, and be sure that you've advised the pediatric provider that this is a part of the story. You know, alcohol is such a pervasive part of our culture. I think we have to get to the place of, it's like anything else. Like I had exposure to COVID. I had exposure to an STD. I had some alcohol exposure. You know, whatever it is, it's part of the story. It's just the facts. And we haven't done a good job, you know, still in today's world, communicating what somebody in the prenatal world might know about that prenatal story if they ask the right questions in a way that got an answer. Because there can be some very judgmental conversations that happen. Mm-hmm. You don't drink, do you? I mean, there's ways to have that conversation. That's not it.
clearly. That would not be the approach.
No, but the bottom line is, I think you you have to establish a relationship with the person and really help them walk that walk.
Terry, the information you sent about core messages related to FASD, in that information, there's a statistic that says only 1 in 600 individuals affected by prenatal alcohol exposure will receive an FASD diagnosis. What do you think needs to happen in order to have a better picture of who would benefit from a screening and the services that could then be provided?
Good question. I think that awareness and education is the first step to help people understand that it's something that can happen. Again, we a lot of times face people who don't believe that that drinking alcohol during pregnancy can actually impact a fetus. So many people, I hear this constantly. People say, well, my mom drank during pregnancy and I'm fine. Or I drank during pregnancy and my kids are fine. And again, we go back to that idea that it depends. It really varies from individual to individual. And the, you know, where one mother might drink 3 glasses of wine during her pregnancy or whatever, 15 glasses of wine. And nothing does seem to appear to happen to her child, where the next mother might do the same thing and will notice effects. And so it really is individual between people and between the children and between the mothers and a whole bunch of variables. So awareness of that right there is a first point, that a first stepping stone I think we can look at. The Alaska Center for FASD is a referral and resource agency or group, I guess. Marilyn founded it in 2017. I'm newly president to that just in the last couple months. So I'm just getting to know the center and its activities. But I know that, like I mentioned before, the Department of Health, State of Alaska, FASD program has been involved in raising awareness for a long time. And the Alaska Prenatal Alcohol Partnership is, it's sort of a follow-up to the Alaska FASD Partnership that operated for 12 years. And the Prenatal Alcohol Partnership is the exact same group and the exact same mission, just a different name. So those entities, the State of Alaska FASD Program, the Prenatal Alcohol Partnership, and the Center for FASD, along with all the diagnostic teams across the state, have been doing things to raise awareness. And I think the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education had a 5-year strategic planning effort that went from 2017 to 2022, and that 9 core messages that you referenced, what everyone should know about prenatal alcohol exposure, that was one of the efforts that came out of that 5-year strategic plan. And the reason that was the first step was because we felt that first and foremost, people needed to be aware of it.
Have the information.
Of prenatal alcohol exposure. And then from there, we can follow up with training for professionals, for corrections professionals, education professionals, medical professionals, legal professionals. The goal really is to, once people are aware, move on to training and really give people some skills on how they can screen and how they can work with people in their purview that have prenatal alcohol exposure or FASD.
All right. Thank you for that rundown. And we are going to take another short break. When we come back, we'll continue with our discussion about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska needs more quality, licensed childcare providers. If you're interested in starting a childcare business, connect with threadalaska.org for support and guidance. There are several resources to get licensed and launched in Alaska. A licensed facility opens doors and opportunities for the business owner and creates a safer, more engaged place for children. You can make a lasting difference in the lives of children and their families. This message sponsored by Thread.
Strong connections can help people thrive during tough times. Whether it's spending quality time with loved ones, finding peace in nature, or the unconditional love of furry companions, these connections help people stay present and have healthier relationships with ourselves and others. Share what makes you feel connected at ChooseConnectionAK.org. This message sponsored by the Alliance.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing FASD, fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, with our guest today, Terry Tibbett, president of the Alaska Center for FASD, Marilyn Pierce-Bulger, a healthcare professional who has worked in FASD healthcare for 30 years, and Gina Shoemaker, who is a self-advocate adult with FASD and on the board of directors for the center. I wanted to get to a question about retired Superior Court Judge Michael Jeffrey, who presided over the district court in Utqiagvik and worked hard to help people with FASD who were in his court. In pursuing what's known as procedural fairness in his court, he developed tactics to help people with a disability that have a 1 in 3 chance of being in prison or jail. Talk about Judge Jeffrey's work and how that helped people in his court, and did it also flow into other court settings?
Well, Mike Jeffrey is on the board of directors with the Alaska Center for FASD.
That's fantastic.
We're proud to say. He's probably listening to this show at the moment, so maybe he'll call in. One of the things about his work that's so powerful is he did indeed recognize that, you know, justice processes really are not something that an individual with a brain-based difference can easily navigate. And he shifted how he did business to make that easier. He also was influential in the mitigating factors laws that have actually been adopted, I think, by the Bar Association nationally, and there are states that are also doing that. Now, one of the caveats related to that, as I understand it, is that it depends on the level of the offense, whether or not you can use that. But it's also very difficult to get the records related to the diagnostic process for some of these individuals. They may not know they went through a diagnostic process if it happened when they were a young child. And B, the lawyers may have difficulty getting it because of HIPAA-related mm-hmm. issues. So the mitigating factors things, I think, have not borne out the fruit that they were hoping that it would in terms of moderating how individuals with FASD experience the judicial systems.
Well, I'm happy to hear that Judge Jeffrey is on your board and continuing his work in helping people with FASD. Let's go to the phones for just a moment. We're getting close to the top of the hour. Hope is on the line from Anchorage. Hello.
Hello, this is Hope Finkelstein. Thank you so much for hosting the show, and thank you for the participants who are active FASD champions for many, many years. I just wanted to share the value of this, the premiere for the film that really highlights the issues of adults. And I think I just wanted to really course correct that the idea that what's been happening and why things have changed, people have been focusing fetal alcohol spectrum disorders on a diagnosis. The diagnosis is actually, as Marilyn shared, is very challenging. And globally, there's not a consensus of how the diagnoses under this umbrella condition is actually done. And so we're in a pivotal moment right now whereas we're moving, rather than centering the diagnosis, really looking at expanding the narrative to looking at what are the effects of alcohol. Alcohol is really the condition, the driver, the factor that causes the disability. And as Terry was sharing, the committee was very forthright and very, really felt strongly that the issue was around prenatal alcohol exposure, not necessarily just the diagnoses under FASD. Mm. And so, and that also relates to, for 50 years, so much of attention has been focused on an individual level, telling specifically women not to drink, whereas the issues around alcohol are systemic. It affects the entire public, society, all ages, all genders, all races, all ethnicities. And so there's real value because there's been focus and this idea that Alaska has the highest prevalence, not only of the conditions, but alcohol use. But when we look at it really historically, Alaska was visionary many years ago with political support and Indian Health Service and funding. We've actually looked at the condition. So where you look, you will see. And so this is where we, as Terry mentioned, we have been the only ones with the diagnosis, diagnostic clinics. So there's a lot of misinformation that we're really hoping with all the awareness and education that we're doing that people from across the lifespan, adults, youth, children, will all get improvement and will all be able to be served. And Alaska as a whole, because we know schools, justice systems, all kinds of systems are impacted.
Absolutely, yes. Well, Hope, thank you for the call. We only have a couple minutes left, and I want to get to the documentary. And Terry, tell us when and where the documentary will be shown and how people can get more information.
Sure. Thank you for that. So the Alaska documentary is called 8 Keys for Adults with FASD, and it features 7 adults with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders telling their stories, talking about their challenges, their strengths, of course, an important aspect of it, and also their strategies for success. The showing happens at the Beartooth Theater Pub on Friday, September 8th at 2:30 in the afternoon. And it's free. We have a suggested donation that people can offer at the door, but no one will be refused admittance if offering a donation. If you have questions or want to know, you can contact me. My email is terry@alaskacenterforfasd.org. And that would be a great way to get through. And also it's in Anchorage, I should say. The Beartooth Theater Pub is in Anchorage. And I think that's all that I can say about it. Again, it was produced with generous support from the State of Alaska FASD program. And Deb Evanson and Marilyn Pierce Bulger were producers. There's 7 cast members and a narrator, whose names we probably don't have time, but I you could go to our website and you can learn about it, the Alaska Center for FASD.
And we'll link to that to your website on the Talk of Alaska page so that folks can find it there too. And in our final moment here, Marilyn, I wanted to ask about you. Started a support group for teenagers and their caregivers, but you had trouble with resourcing. But now there's some federal funds that are going to help. Can you quickly give us an update about that?
So there is some federal funding that should be coming as of September, and the center is getting about half of what they were expecting, but that will help to support some work around raising awareness, hopefully some support sorts of groups potentially, and potentially looking at telehealth model for diagnostic outreach, because there are professionals around the state who have been trained and know how to do the work, but they don't have a team they're working with, so they may be interested in doing a telehealth related system.
Mm-hmm. All right, Gina, any final thoughts from you?
No, I'm just glad to be here, and I'm glad we're raising awareness and ending the stigma.
All right. Well, thank you for your work on behalf of yourself and other Alaskans who are facing these challenges.
Thank you.
Thanks so much to our guests today, Terry Tibbett, Marilyn Pierce Bulger, and Gina Shoemaker. And thanks to our team. On the engineering team is Chris Hyde. Our producer is Madeline Rose. And on the phones today, Tobin Shelby helped us out. This is KSKA's 45th anniversary. And next Monday on KSKA's Hometown Alaska, the program will focus on the history and importance of KSKA's public radio service to Alaskans. Tune in and join us in this celebration. Thanks for listening today. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.